Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, Associate Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Isabella Alexander, author of Copyright and Cartography, History, Law, and the Circulation of Geographical Knowledge, published in 2023 by Hart Publishing. Dr. Alexander, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
To start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Okay, well... I'm a professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Technology, Sydney, and I mainly research in the history of copyright law. I started thinking about this book when I was just finishing up my first book, which was based on my doctoral dissertation, and I was living and working in Cambridge, and my PhD in that book was on the history of copyright in books in the 19th century. And so I was just finishing that up, and someone sent me a link to a talk that was happening in Cambridge at Emmanuel College by someone, Lawrence Worms, who'd been researching into the map trade in the 18th century. And both of us thought, oh, this would be an interesting, you know, there's a lot of scholarship about copyright in books, but less a scholarship on the other subject matters of copyright. So maps was something that no one had really looked at that much at all. And so that seemed like an interesting area to explore. And at the time I thought, I couldn't actually go to the talk, but I thought that's an interesting area and maybe I'll look into it and write an article on copyright in maps. And 12 years later, I've written an entire book on it, which also the only reason the book is in the world now is because I actually cut out a lot of the material that I was going to use because I thought otherwise the book will never be finished. But I just ended up, I guess, thinking, going down a real rabbit hole because I realized that maps were not just a different kind of copyright work. There was a whole lot of really fascinating map history scholarship that it was interesting to me to engage with. And so I enrolled at a course on history of cartography at the London School of Rare Books to try and get a little bit more background on this kind of other discipline, I guess, that I was not really familiar with at all. So I did have a history background, but not in the specific history of cartography. And I guess, as you probably know, the history of cartography draws from so many different disciplines. So there's geographers, historians, political scientists, and they all bring, you know, their different kind of unique insights and disciplines to it. So there was kind of a lot to get on top of. And the more I read, the more I thought that they were an important part of the story of the history of copyright in maps. And it wasn't just going to be a story about, you know, how did maps change copyright law doctrine, but how did copyright affect the map trade and the way that information is presented and circulated. So yes, so that's how I got into that. And I would, because I was in the UK when I started the project, I was just going to look at Britain. And my PhD had just been on Britain. But after I started, I moved to Australia. And I applied for funding from the Australian Research Council to continue the project. And at that time, I thought, well, since I'm applying to the ARC, I should probably have an Australian aspect to the book. And I thought that would bring a really important kind of maps are always, I guess, about empire, but having a kind of a perspective from the center of empire and then the periphery of empire was going to bring something really interesting to the book. But in the end, I did have to cut out the Australian material and kind of save that for a future project because it was, I guess, one issue too many really to try and hold together in a coherent book. So that is still a really interesting story that I want to tell, but it's not in this book. But yeah, so that's, I guess, the story of how I came to write the book.
Yeah, well, I, for one, would definitely be interested if you write a part two with the Australian angle. And so
Say there's probably also a part three because I do stop at the outbreak of World War One. So there's another really interesting story later on.
Yeah, it's definitely a fertile field for further research. And so, as you said, the history of cartography draws on a lot of different perspectives, but the history of copyright is not a perspective that I've come across very often in reading about that. And probably a lot of our listeners who might have a geography background probably haven't thought about that aspect as much. So could you give us just kind of a sketch of the development of copyright law in Britain during the period you're talking about so that we can then, you know, connect maps to those developments?
Yeah. So, the period I'm talking about is a really long period. As I said, I kind of thought I would start at the beginning about the 18th century, and then I went further into the 19th century and also backwards to see what kind of, you know, to trace the prehistory. So the reason I started in the 18th century is the first copyright statutes were passed in the early 18th century. So in 1710 was the first legislation to regulate the copying of books. And 1735 was the first act to apply that same kind of regime to engravings. Now, maps are engravings, but they weren't specifically named until a statute of 1767. But before 1710, there was still forms of regulating the book and print trade, and this was generally done through the use throughout Europe of royal privileges or privileges from the particular ruler of the state, because in some cases the Pope also granted privileges. So this was a kind of a royal authority that people would petition for from the ruler to be, and they began in Venice in the 13th century, not about books particularly, but just about any kind of technology. So if you wanted to bring a technology into the realm or into the city of Venice, you could apply for a privilege to be the only person who was working that technology. So it was a kind of a form of protectionism, but it was very effective in Venice. It meant that it kind of became a center of trade and technology. And eventually that was spread out to the rest of Europe, and it began to be used to cover all sorts of things, you know, from playing cards to books and also maps. So map makers were using this instrument, as were booksellers and printers, to try and get an exclusive right for their books or their productions. And in the UK, this was also supplemented by another form of regulation of the book trade, which was carried out through the Stationers' Company, which was a London guild. And it essentially controlled the book trade because you had to be a member of the Stationers' Company to print and publish books, and you entered them into a register. And the Stationers' Company worked also with whoever the ruler was at the time to enforce a censorship regime that sat alongside the registration regime. So the king or the queen was interested in censorship, and the Stationers' Company was interested in regulating the trade and maintaining its monopoly. So they worked quite nicely together up until the end of the 17th century. And mapmakers, again, were able to take advantage of both of these regimes. Not all mapmakers were members of the Stationers' Company. Some of them were. And some of them you could also ask a stationer to enter the book into the register as well. But by the end of the 17th century, there was a kind of a growing resistance to monopolies. And they were monopolies like in the form of monopolies that a ruler would grant to a particular favourite or someone who petitioned them, as well as trade monopolies exercised by guilds like the London the Stationers' Company. And this kind of spilled into resistance to these forms of regulation alongside kind of resistance to censorship and licensing attitudes to that were changing as well. And so there was this kind of confluence, I guess, of influences that led to so the licensing acts, which kind of sat alongside the stationer's registration, lapsed, and instead of renewing them, it was Parliament decided to introduce this new form of protection, which was a Copyright Act, which is known as the Statute of Anne, or an Act for the Encouragement of Learning. So it's framed as an act for the encouragement of learning, but really it was an act to kind of appease the booksellers and give them back some power. But it was different to the system that operated before because you didn't have to be a member of the company. So you did have to enter a book in a register, but anyone could enter a book. So it could be the author of the book or someone that an author transferred their title in the manuscript to. So that was a big change. It kind of undermined the power of the Stationers' Company. The privilege system did continue. People kept on using them, and it kind of, I guess, it dribbled out towards the end of the 18th century. So then we had this regime that applied to books, and in 1735, under petitioning, a group of engravers led by William Hogarth petitioned for a similar kind of protection for engravings. So we had that regime, and then, as I said, in 1767, they were identified that there are a few problems with this regime, and an amending act was passed, and this time it explicitly included that the protection against copying would extend to maps, charts, or plans. So that's kind of, I guess, we're now at the kind of the mid-18th century, and we have a statutory regime in place that is, I guess, the foundation of modern copyright law, although, of course, it changes a lot in the intervening 300 years.
Yeah, and you talk about a few ways that maps didn't quite fit into the copyright concepts that might apply to something like like a novel or a textual book. And one of those has to do with authorship because maps were usually like team projects more so than, your classic idea of a book that you have one author. Jane Austen sits down and writes Pride and Prejudice, and it's her book, from her own personal creation, whereas maps would have a lot of people involved in it. So how did that affect how copyright got applied to maps?
Well, it's interesting because I think the map thing, if you think about it a little bit, it highlights a fiction that already existed. So you'll hear people say, "Oh, copyright is about," and from the beginning has been about encouraging authors. But the truth is, I mean, I guess as I've sketched out before, it was really about protecting publishers or booksellers as they were in those days. So the people that provided the funding to publish the books. Authors might be the incidental beneficiaries, but is I guess at least in the early days, probably authors were selling their manuscripts outright. There may have been some people who are able to kind of negotiate something similar to the kind of royalty agreements we see today. But really, although the protection begins with an author, so it's the author who has the right, it's right from the beginning, it's the publisher who's exercising that right. So in that sense, a map, the map is similar because the right would go to the map maker, who would generally be the person who brings together that kind of range of skills and invests the money. So sometimes there's some examples, I guess, of well-known map makers who were also engravers. So Thomas Jeffries is an example. But even those people don't engrave all of their own maps. And it's not just the engravers. So you need the geographer who compiles the information, maybe a surveyor, not always. the printer, even amongst engravings, there were specialty areas. So some people would specialize in engraving hills, and then some people would specialize in the lettering. So yes, as you say, they were always a collaborative endeavor, but the right was concentrated in the person who printed and published the map, which was in reality the map maker. So it does, as I guess time goes on, particularly in the 19th century, as this kind of romantic, what's sometimes called the romantic ideal of copyright takes over, this notion that I guess draws on romantic theory about the author and their central role in creating a text. And maps sit uncomfortably with that as that idea takes over, and so copyright is kind of mapped onto that romantic ideal of an author and their creative powers. So it's quite interesting, I guess. It wasn't really a tension in the beginning, because although people talked about the author, it was understood that it was a right to protect the entrepreneur. But later on, that kind of rhetoric about the role of the author does sit in tension with how copyright actually works in relation to maps, because they don't just have one author, but the right tends to be held by the person who brings all of that labor together.
Yes, then another issue that comes up a bunch throughout the book is this tension between the idea of the map as like information that's useful for society to have out there, but then on the other hand, the actual physical map as a commodity that somebody's going to sell and make money from. So what made those two ideas salient during this period and then difficult to reconcile?
I think they're always salient and always difficult to reconcile, but you do see them emerging over this 200 year period, partly because maps are... works of information, as you say, but they're also valued as singular items in a way that a book is not. So you've got this kind of, yes, so there's the singularity, the uniqueness of the particular map that you've got, which has a value, and people do all sorts of things with maps, only, you know, relatively recently use them to find their way around. So copyright... When copyright arrives, it drives up not only the price of the individual of it as a commodity or a physical object, because now it's harder to make copies of that, so it makes the physical object more valuable, but it also regulates that right to make copies. So there's now a second right that can be licensed or assigned to a different person, to the person who owns the physical object. And that's it's a tension, as I say. You don't see it with books, because the value of a book is in the information that's in it and not in the particular copy, unless it's a valuable first edition or created handmade object in some way. But maps are, because they're, you know, the value is in the hand labor of it, and in that sense they're also like other artworks. And I mean, paintings and drawings were not actually protected by copyright until much later in the 19th century, and then it was quite controversial. A lot of people said it was a completely inappropriate right to apply to original works like paintings. It should just be just a reproduction right, so it's for about a work that can be reproduced, that copies of which are valuable. So, yeah, so quite controversial. And I think what's interesting, I guess, is we're starting to see this again coming up as an issue today with new forms of technology. So with things like NFTs, now people are trying to think of ways to create, to make an infinitely reproducible article unique as an object. So digital art, which you can have every copy of it, will be identical to every other copy of it. How do you create value in one object? And NFTs are one way of doing that. So as I say, I think it's, you know, copyright created that tension, and it never really goes away in works like this where the value is twofold.
So then could you talk about some of the work that went into compiling and creating a map in the days before we had easy access to GIS data everywhere, and then how doing all that work influenced the way mapmakers would defend themselves in these copyright lawsuits that form kind of one of the major things that you draw on to show how copyright was evolving through all these lawsuits. So how did the labor of actually compiling the map come up in those disputes?
So the labor is always integral right from the beginning. And you even see it in some of the early privileges where they talk about, I've worked really hard on this, the product of my labor and my expense and my investment. So there's the labor and there's the investment. And people petitioning for privileges in the early days will talk about those things. So right at the beginning, it's always seen as the value flows from the labor, and the right is an attempt to capture that value and make it into something that can be transacted. So there's that side of it. And as you say, you really see it again coming out through the cases. And one of the things I do in the book is I use the cases as my primary source for exploring how people are thinking about maps at the time and how they're trying to, frame the labor in terms that the law will understand. So the labor has kind of two roles in relation to the map. So first of all, if you're in litigation, whether it's the 18th century or the 19th century, you have to start by proving that you have a right to the particular work in question. And one of the ways that people do that is the labor. So I didn't, you say, and there's also good kinds of labor and bad kinds of labor. So because the other thing is, it was actually not easy to copy a map. It wasn't like, you could just take a photograph of it or put it on the photocopier. So even copying required labor. So you had to show also that you had expended the right kind of labor. Because merely making a copy, if all you've done is copy, an exact version of the first map, that's the wrong kind of labor. So you have to, complainants, plaintiffs would have to show that they had expended the right kind of labor. So even if they had copied, and of course in the early days in the 18th and 19th century, maps were almost invariably copied from other maps, but you had to show that you had made corrections, improved the map, used a variety of sources, not just one source, that gave rise to the map in question, that meant that you had a right that you could then assert against someone else, the person that you were saying copied your map in the wrong way, using the wrong kind of labor. So that was, and you see that again and again over the kind of 200-year period that I'm talking about, is how you capture that labor and then how you use that labor. And then defendants would defend themselves by using the same argument and say, they might say, yes, I did copy it, but I improved it. So it shouldn't be an infringement, or I copied from it. That was just one of many sources that I drew from, I expend a lot of my own resources on this. So map kind of the labor comes in at every point. Yeah.
Right. And then you have chapters about two major government institutions that were very involved in mappings, the Ordnance Survey and the Hydrographic Office. And how did their approaches to copyright differ?
So they were really interesting organizations to look at, because the rest of my book is looking at the private map trade. And although private map makers are interested in, or they say they are interested in, they probably are, because you don't really go into map making to make a fortune. Kind of benefiting the public with their improved maps, the Ordnance Survey and the Hydrographic Office were organisations that were explicitly set up by the state with the object of kind of providing this useful information to benefit the public generally. So copyright from the beginning creates a tension there. And with the Ordnance Survey, it's interesting to trace its development over the years, and quite difficult. It's a really complicated story. And There's some areas of the archives are really full and some are a little bit missing. And there's problems with both of that, too much information and not enough information. But I was able to draw on some really helpful existing studies to kind of help find my way through that. But what you've got with the Ordnance Survey is in their early years, and it starts out kind of following the Battle of Culloden and realising that the Highlands are a mystery to the occupying English forces. So they set up the Ordnance Survey to map that area to try and find out what it is. So this starts off with this military objective, but almost immediately private interests come into play. And there's some kind of what we would guess call a public-private partnerships going on. And also, because we're now kind of at the tail end of the Enlightenment, these ideals about scientific knowledge and men of science are also interested in what can we learn about the land that we live in through mapping it, and what kind of great techniques, new techniques and things like theodolites and fancy technologies can we use to get to know this better? So there's always this interplay of the scientific, the military, the public operating there. So how does copyright play in? Well, at first, the directors of the Ordnance Survey are really happy for their scientific information to be shared. And that is interesting. You'd think that would be in tension with the military objectives, but by and large, with a few small exceptions of militarily significant maps, which are kept secret, the vast majority of this information is made as available as possible through publications like the Philosophical Transactions. And then that starts to shift. And also the other thing is that first it's just the Ordnance Survey is really just a survey. And soon then they think, well, we should make maps with this, but they don't have the expertise to make maps, so they need to bring that in from outside. So they need to turn to the private trade who knows how to make maps. And they've got the networks and they know how to bring those things together to produce a map, and also how to sell the maps, because they think if we're going to produce these maps, then we should sell them, which will be great for members of the public, but also can help us to recoup some of these enormous costs. And that again now creates a tension, because they want to sell the maps to recoup costs. How will they do that? They need monopolists always do, they need a monopoly right, because otherwise they won't be able to compete in that market, particularly against the private map trade, who know the market so much better than they do, who very easily just take their information, put it into their own maps and undercut them. But so they need copyright to stop that from happening, but then copyright slows down the spread of the information. So the directors of the Ordnance Survey are always throughout history very conflicted by this and how to resolve it, because they all genuinely want the information to be made as widely available as possible, but they also want to sell their maps, and Treasury gets increasingly shirty about how much money the survey is costing them, and puts more and more pressure on them to sell the maps for a profit, which then leads to the information not being made available. So they have various compromises in the Ordnance Survey. The Hydrographic Office has the same debate, but it's much more, the public interest is even more compelling in the case of the Hydrographic Office, because the consequences of an inaccurate map are fatal. So I think as someone says at one point, nobody is going to die if an Ordnance Survey map has a hedge in the wrong place, but, you know, lots of people will die if a rock is placed in the wrong place in the ocean. So the Hydrographic Office people always push back much more strongly on this notion that they should be selling their maps, their charts, as I should say, for money. But they have the same problems because they want them to be disseminated. They want the hydrographic charts to be carried on every ship. But how do they get them onto the ships, and how do they make sure they're the most up-to-date version? So they have a whole other aspect that they actually directly supplying the Navy. But that's a huge, as you can imagine, logistical challenge, especially as they're updating their charts all the time. So they need to have a way of recalling the old inaccurate charts and getting the new charts out onto the ships. And then what happens with the merchant marine, who have their own kind of system of charts, which are called the bluebacks, which are a different kind of chart. They take the information from the hydrographic office, but then there's this kind of branding problem as well. If the blueback chart says on it, with information from the hydrographic office, or some refers to it, and then the blueback itself is wrong, there's a chance that people will blame the hydrographic office, and this will lead to a loss of faith in the hydrographic office charts, which will mean that, you know, have again serious consequences because people won't use them and they might die, or they might not buy them. So then they have the problem with selling them to make enough money. So that's the copyright is really important in that dynamic, but it's attenuated differently in the context of the state's involvement.
Yes, and I'd also love to hear more about the research process behind this book. Like, how did you go about tracking down all of these court records and letters and stuff that you're using as your source material to tell this story?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for that question. I guess because I'm a lawyer, I started with the legal record. And that is also a really helpful place to start, especially in the older period, because there's not that many other archives. Map makers don't seem to have, well, if they have archives, they've been lost or destroyed over the years. So aside from the amazing Bartholomew's archive in Scotland, there's not too many other kind of really good archives of map makers. So the legal records have a lot of information in it. And I tend to just, so I started with the cases and the names of people that I knew. So in the 18th century, the map and chart trade is pretty small, so you can carry out searches at the National Archives. The Chancery records are searchable by the names of the parties now online, which is fantastic. And fortunately, it seems that most, copyright cases were very, Chancery was a popular venue for copyright cases because in the Court of Chancery, the remedy that you can get is an injunction. And mostly in copyright cases, what people want is the other person to stop doing something. Although there's not usually a huge amount of money in it. So mainly Chancery, they'll at some point probably end up or start out in Chancery to try and get an injunction, and also maybe a discovery of documents which they can then use to take to one of the common law courts. Common law courts are much harder to search in, and the finding aids are more complicated. So there could be like a huge treasure trove of cases in the King's Bench and the Common Pleas that I haven't found, and that would be exciting and great. So that was kind of for the legal records. That's a painstaking process. There's also, especially as time goes on, newspapers are always interested in copyright cases. So there's often in the newspapers of the day, cases are reported. So you can do, especially as over the period of time that I've been working in this area, the digital finding aids and the online newspapers have become so amazing, and the OCR is so good that you can search by names of parties that you think are likely to have litigated, but also just by copyright and map and things like that. So sometimes you can find it in a newspaper and then go back and trace it through the legal record. And then the institutional archives. So the Ordnance Survey has an enormous archive that's now held at the National Archives in London. The Hydrographic Office, I had to travel to Taunton in Somerset, which is where their archives are, although I believe that they're now transferring some of them down to London. So those were the main archives I visited. Some of the 18th century chart makers have an archive in St Ives in Cambridgeshire, and they were really great there, although they don't have enormous amounts of material. And then I guess it's like most other historical things, you kind of track down bits of that, learn you the clues that you get as you go. And because I was also interested, so I started off being interested in the cases, but I'm also really interested in the people. So for me, this is a story about people's interactions with the law. So once you've got a case and people in the case, then research into the the lives and the interests of the people involved, so I could try and tell their story and see them as humans interacting with a system and running a business as well. So how did they think about their business? How do they think about, their role in society as people who had taken on this, I guess, important public task in lots of cases of creating and disseminating geographic information? Was that something that was important to them? Can you gather that from the traces that are left behind?
Yeah, there's definitely some interesting characters in here and people that all pop up again and again involved in different disputes over the years. Were there any individuals that you particularly stood out to you as sort of interesting people or surprising people?
Oh, so many of them. You just don't have enough time. I mean, in the early period, the story of John Ogilvie is a great one, and there's a few good books on him as well lately, which is this is fun to trace down because he had such a amazing career as a dancer and a theatre owner and a bookseller before he became a map maker. And yeah, this is someone like in the 18th century, John Hamilton Moore, who was obviously very feisty and kind of manipulated the system and had kind of strong allies and strong relationships, and also enemies who would kind of print scurrilous rumors about him and paste them up around the town, including kind of the accusations he debauched his servant and he engaged in copyright infringement. So all of these things were kind of thrown together as he was a generally bad lot. And then, yeah, the people that come out through the Bartholomew Archive, when you can see them writing letters to each other and saying, I'm caught up in this dreadful copyright case, and it's making me, it's affecting my health. Or they're kind of gossiping about each other. Oh, they got caught up in this case. I feel, so bad for them. They'll probably lose everything. So it just you get this sense of them as personalities, which is really interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I think that comes through well in the book. So as we're moving towards the end of our time here, I wanted to give you an opportunity to give a shout out or a thank you to anyone whose help was important to you as you were writing the book.
Oh my God, we would be here forever. I worked on this book for 12 years, so if I start calling people out, worried that I'll forget someone. But I guess I really would want to thank Lionel Bentley from the University of Cambridge, who kind of suggested he was the one who sent me the hey, this seminar's on in the first place, and talked about it through the years and read large sections of the manuscript. And also my colleague Tomás Gómez Rostegui, who's at Lewis and Clark Law School, who knows everything there is to know about how to research legal records on copyright at the National Archives, and just couldn't have got even close to where I got without his help, which was amazing. And then so many great people in the map history community. Like Lawrence Worms and Catherine Delano Smith and Matthew Edney, who were always really generous with their time and answering my stupid questions about where to go next. And yeah, all the people who read sections of the book and yeah, listen to me go on about it. And also my family, who put up with it for a long time. Not always with good grace in the case of my children, I think it would be fair to say.
Yeah, well, then that brings us to our traditional final question on the New Books Network, which is, what are you working on next?
Oh, well, I kind of started out with this as well. So I've got all my Australian material that I'm really excited to work up. So that's kind of staying on the map project. And also, so looking at the history of engraving, so I kind of touched on that, and it's an area that hasn't really been, I mean, when I started this project, I thought people would have written a lot about copyright in engravings in the 18th century, and there's really not that much out there at all. So now that I've kind of worked out how to find all of these cases, I want to go back and do that history, but that's much more intertwined with the history of art because of, as I mentioned, William Hogarth was heavily involved. So I'm going to do that project I'm with a colleague, Christina Martinez at Ottawa, who is an art historian and has that kind of expertise because, you know, it took me so long to get on top of map history and I just don't think I can also get on top of art history. And there's lots of experts out there who already know more than I could ever learn. So, yeah, so a project on the history of engravings is my other kind of, yeah, historical project going forward. Yes, and yeah, various other things, but those are the main kind of book projects, I guess.
Okay, well, we'll be on the lookout for those when they come out. So thank you so much for coming on the show today.
And thank you so much for having me. It's great.
This has been a conversation with Isabella Alexander, author of Copyright and Cartography, History, Law, and the Circulation of Geographical Knowledge, published in 2023 by Hart Publishing.